Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Transportation to order, April 3rd, 2018. Time is 1:32 p.m. We have...
What's his name?
No, we have Senator Egan and Senator Wilson here and myself, Stedman. So we have a quorum. We have two items of business up today. First item will be Senate Bill 199, Dalton Highway, Access to Private Property, and we'll follow it up with House Bill 259, Confining Vehicle Loads, and these are the first hearings on both these bills, so we'll hear them and set them aside for now. With that, I'd like to go ahead and start with Senate Bill 199, an act relating to the use of off-road vehicles within the James-Dalton Highway Corridor. And if I could have representation from Senator Kelly's office, Mr. Joe Burns, come forward, please. He's going to introduce the bill for the committee. And then we'll have a public hearing and go through the process. You can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and tell us about this bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Joe Burns, staff to Senator Pete Kelly. Mr. Chair, Senator Kelly deeply regrets that he's unable to introduce the bill in person today, but we appreciate you and the members of the Senate Transportation Committee taking the time to hear SB 199 this afternoon. Senate Bill 199 would allow for the use of off-road vehicles within the James Dalton Highway Corridor to access private property with an established history of use as a homestead. Mr. Chair, under AS 1940-210, off-road vehicles are not permitted on land within 5 miles of the highway right-of-way except under select circumstances. One, if necessary for oil and gas exploration, development, or transportation. Two, to gain access to a mining claim in the vicinity of the highway. And three, to travel across the corridor from a point outside the corridor to another point outside the corridor with a snow machine. Unfortunately, this leaves no exception for individuals and their families who own private homesteaded land adjacent to the corridor who wish to use an off-road vehicle to access their property. This issue came to our office's attention from a constituent who owns homesteaded property in the Brooks Range that is virtually inaccessible in winter months without an airplane under current law. Article 8, Section 1 of the Alaska Constitution states, "It is the policy of the state to encourage the settlement of its land and the development of its resources by making them available for the maximum use consistent with the public interest." This section was one of the reasons the legislature found there was an immediate need for a public highway from the Yukon River to the Arctic Ocean in the first place. Mr. Chair, homesteading has a rich history in Alaska, going back to the extension of the original Homestead Act to include Alaska by President William McKinley in 1898. By the time the last homestead claims were made in the 1980s, around 3,500 people had received land in Alaska, according to BLM. Homesteaders represent the very embodiment of the state's desire to settle Alaska. However, for a myriad of reasons, access has long plagued residents of our state. The prohibition on off-road vehicles is a holdover from a time when there was concern about the lack of sufficient public facilities and services available on the Dalton Highway. Today, the Dalton Highway includes amenities familiar to any traveler on Alaska's highways: restaurants, fuel stations, lodging, campgrounds, water fill-up and dump stations, and rest areas. It is long time that some of these restrictions on the use of the Dalton Highway be reevaluated. At the very least, this reevaluation should begin with this bill, SB 199. This proposes a very limited exception only for persons wishing to access private property that was historically used as a homestead. The Department of Natural Resources has located only 16 federally patented homesteads within 10 miles of the Dalton Highway. Furthermore, SB 199 would not upend Board of Game restrictions on the use of off-road vehicles for hunting purposes in the area, or restrictions on the use of firearms within the corridor for hunting. Mr. Chair, SB 199 is a bill of very narrow scope that is about giving homestead property holders the same access rights as those with mining claims and those seeking oil and gas development. That concludes my remarks. Thank you for hearing SB 199, And I'm available for any questions. And I believe there should be some people from DPS and DNR and DOT available for any other technical questions.
Do we have any questions from committee members before we start to open to the public? Okay, seeing none. Go ahead and start with the public hearing portion. We'll go to Fairbanks first. If you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill. Rebecca Vanderlott?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Okay, if you can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill, please.
My name is Rebecca Vanderlott, and I represent just private citizens who own property through the Federal Homestead Act. I am one of those private landowners. I own a land that was patented under the Federal Homestead Act, and I am in support of this bill because I believe that we have a right to equal access to our property. It is virtually inaccessible in winter, and we would like to travel there via snow machine to have access to it through the winter months.
Okay. Do you happen to know what your homestead number was on that particular parcel? The original patent number?
The patent number is, I don't think I brought it with me. Hold on, I'm looking at my notes. I do not have the patent number with me. I apologize.
Okay, that's fine. Okay, well, thank you for your testimony. Next up, we'll go to the off-net. We'll go to Palmer. Rod Arnold.
Yes, thank you, Mitch. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Arnold, you're breaking up really bad. If you could try again and introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, please.
Thank you. Yes. My name is Rod Arnold. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Outdoor Kickout Organization, or Outdoor Folks, representing 10,000 Alaskans. The Alaska Outdoor Council does support Senate Bill 199, that clearly it will provide more public access to public resources than the Constitution. And for that reason, access for Alaskans to public as well as private lands, we do support this. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. And you could also submit written testimony because it was kind of broken up. You can submit that to the committee if you wish. The other folks online are just for questions. Do we have anybody here in the room that would like to come forward, speak to the bill? Have the bill sponsor come forward. Just for entertainment, Charles Stedman's homestead number was 56. I was just checking to see how old that one homestead was, but...
Mr. Chair, Ms. Vanderloot and her husband are actually our constituents who initially brought this to our attention, and their site is a headquarters site, which was a type of homestead that was amended in under FDR. If you'd like, I can share the patent with the committee if you'd like.
You happen to know the homestead number? It'd be nice, just for entertainment.
It is all on my computer, but I do not have it on the top of my head.
That's fine. Hey, do we have any other questions for the bill sponsor before we set this bill aside? Okay, seeing none, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside for future action. Next up, House Bill 259, an act relating to containing and confining loads being transported on highways. We have Representative Stutes here before us and a trusty aide of hers, so if she can introduce herself for the record, who she represents, and then tell the committee what this bill is, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Stedman, Senator Egan, and Senator Wilson. I'm Representative Louise Stutes, and I represent House District 32, which The larger areas are Kodiak, Cordova, Yakutat, and I also represent several small coastal communities. On House Bill 259, I brought this bill forward on behalf of an Alaskan who was grievously injured as a result of someone failing to properly secure their cargo in their vehicle. This bill addresses a serious gap in our confined load statute, which will protect the safety of Alaskan drivers and pedestrians. In Alaska, even if you are seriously injured as a result of someone's negligence in securing their load, the current confined load statute only allows for a $300 traffic infraction. Additionally, the current confined load statute only applies to sand, gravel, rock, or similar materials, leaving out a litany of objects that can injure or kill other drivers or pedestrians. This bill updates Alaska's confined load statute to include all materials that escape your vehicle with a few specific exemptions. It also requires maintaining 6 inches of freeboard or tarping loads consisting of sand, gravel, rock, or similar materials. It is a responsible public safety measure that will reduce injuries, fatalities, property damage, and roadway litter. It will be a move in moving Alaska one step ahead. And in describing the bill in detail, I will turn it over to my committee aide, Matt Greening.
Matt, if you want to introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and take us through this bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, for the record, Matt Greening, staff to Representative Louise Stutz. Thank you for the opportunity to present this bill. Whether someone overflows the bed of their truck with rocks and gravel, plywood, scrap metal, loose debris on the way to the dump, or simply fails to tie down large objects in a flatbed, unsecured loads are an undisputed hazard to other users of the roadway and pedestrians. Improperly secured loads can cause serious injuries, property damage, and fatalities. The AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety concluded that from 2011 to 2014, road debris was a factor in more than 200,000 police-reported crashes. Those crashes resulted in approximately 39,000 injuries and 500 deaths. Additionally, the report found that about two-thirds of these accidents were the result of items falling from a vehicle due to unsecured loads and improper maintenance. In another study by the U.S. Government Accountability Office, it was found that there were approximately 440 fatalities caused by roadway debris in 2010. That data was gathered by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. All 50 states have laws that require drivers to properly secure loads in any vehicle or trailer and impose fees that range from $10 to $5,000. In most states, failing to properly secure a load is a traffic violation. In Alaska, as the representative indicated, even if it results in a serious physical injury, it is an infraction punishable by a fine not to exceed $300. However, in 15 states, they have instituted possible criminal penalties for failing to properly secure loads. I would also like to note that there is a legislative research report in members' packets that compares those laws and provides additional information about Maria's Law in Washington State, which this legislation closely resembles. Last year, the state of Alaska, the mayor of Anchorage, the Anchorage Assembly, the mayor of the Matsu Borough, and the Matsu Borough Assembly officially declared June 6th as Secure Your Load Day by issuing proclamations and resolutions recognizing the hazards of failing to take the simple steps of affixing every load. These documents are included in members' packets as well, and I would like to note that in 2016, Solid Waste Services in Anchorage issued 1,392 citations for unsecured loads. HB 59 establishes standards for load securements of all types of materials and requires covering or maintaining 6 inches of freeboard with loads consisting of sand, dirt, rock, gravel, and similar materials. I would like to point out that there is a very high bar in this legislation for somebody to be charged with a misdemeanor. A violation only gets raised to the level of a Class A misdemeanor if a person fails to secure a load with a mental state of criminal negligence and it results in the serious physical injury of another person. Likewise, a violation can only become a Class B misdemeanor if a person fails to secure a load with criminal negligence and it results in $5,000 or more in damage to another person's property. A violation under any other circumstance is a traffic infraction and has a penalty on the first offense of $300, which is consistent with current law. The legislation will decrease roadway litter, property damage, injuries, and fatalities. It is a responsible public safety measure to protect Alaskan drivers and avoid costly repairs that result from the actions or inactions of others. As invited testimony today, I have Robin Abel online and Kelly Roy in the room for testimony. Robin is not only a nationwide expert and advocate regarding load securement, but she's also the mother of Maria Federici, who is the namesake of Maria's Law in Washington State. Robin's 24-year-old daughter, Maria, was struck by a particle board that came out of the back of a trailer in front of her. She was nearly decapitated as debris crushed every bone in her face, leaving her blind. Miraculously, she survived. At the time, in Washington, as is in Alaska currently, there was no law addressing the consequences of that act for unsecured loads, and the driver was cited for a traffic infraction and fined. Robin has dedicated her life to changing the law, educating the public, and doing whatever she can to avoid this happening from others. Thanks to Robin's effort, Washington legislators adopted what's been called Maria's Law, which criminalizes a person's failure to secure a load if, as with this legislation, with criminal intent or criminal negligence and results in serious injury or death. She has been leading education and law-changing efforts across the country, but I'll let her speak to the rest of her story. In the room today, we have Kelly Roy, who is an Alaskan, who the representative Stutes mentioned earlier, who experienced a very similar tragedy to Maria and is also fortunate to be alive. But I will let her tell her story as well. Kelly flew all the way down from Anchorage today to testify. And again, in Alaska, her life has been forever changed. And under the current confined load statute, there was no recourse besides a littering fine. She brought this bill to her office in the hopes of avoiding this happening to others. These types of incidences happen all too often and are completely avoidable by taking the short and simple steps of inspecting a load and securing it, if necessary, before operating a vehicle. Kelly is the impetus and driving force behind this bill, and she has been leading the effort in Alaska to raise awareness and educate the public. I'm truly grateful that she has brought this bill to our office, but also that she had the courage to tell her story to the committee today. With your permission, Mr. Chair, I would walk through the sectional.
That's what we thought you were going to do to start with.
I might have done that a little backwards there. My apologies. So on section 1, page 1, line 3 through page 3, line 9, AS 2535251 is repealed and reenacted. Subsection A on page 1, lines 4 through 7. This subsection states that a person is guilty of the crime of failure to contain or confide a load in the first degree if, with a mental state of criminal negligence, they violate C, and C is the actual act of an unsecured load and describes the offense, and as a result causes serious physical injury to another person. Criminal negligence applies to the act of securing the load versus how somebody may be driving. Failure to contain or confine a load in the first degree is a Class A misdemeanor. Subsection B on page 1, lines 8 through 10, this subsection states that a person is guilty of the crime of failure to contain or confine a load in the second degree if, with criminal negligence, they violate C, and as a result cause property damage of $5,000 or more. Criminal negligence, again, applies to the act of securing a load, and failure to contain or confine a load in the second degree is a Class B misdemeanor. Subsection C, 1A, I, and 2I, and Big B on page 1, line 11 through page 2, line 7. This subsection specifies that a person commits the offense of failure to secure to contain or confine a load in the third degree if a person drives or moves a motor vehicle loaded with any material on a highway unless it is secured or situated in a way that prevents it from escaping the vehicle or shifting to the extent that the vehicle's maneuverability or stability is adversely affected, and the load is treated by methods approved by the regulation by the Department of Public Safety that are designed to settle the load or remove loose material before it is driven on a highway. A failure to contain or confine a load in the third degree is an infraction, as it is in current law. Subsection C2 on page 2, lines 9 through 12. This subsection specifies that a person may drive or move a motor vehicle loaded with sand, gravel, dirt, rock, or similar materials if at least 6 inches of freeboard is maintained around the perimeter or a cover is used and securely fastened. I would like to point out that we use the word perimeter intentionally there so that people would still be allowed the cone in the middle. If they're a contractor, they're still allowed when they're pouring gravel to have that cone in the middle of the truck. Subsection D1 on page 2, lines 13 through 16, this subsection is an exemption that specifies that the provisions of this act do not apply to a vehicle that deposits sand, liquids, or other materials for the purposes of maintaining, cleaning, improving traction on the highway. That's out of current statute. That's in current law right now. Subsection D2 on page 2, lines 17 through 18, this subsection is an exemption that specifies that the provisions of this act do not apply to the natural accumulation of snow, ice, mud, dirt, or similar materials. Subsection D3 on page 2, line 19. This subsection is an exemption that specifies that the provisions of this act do not apply to a vehicle that is removing snow or hauling snow after removal. So DOT vehicles, municipal vehicles that are shoveling snow into a dump truck and clearing them off the highway. We exempted those as well. Subsection D4 on page 2, lines 2 through 21. Or lines 20 through 21, excuse me. This subsection is an exemption that specifies that the provisions of this act do not apply to random litter escaping a vehicle, and litter is defined in this section as plastic wrappers, empty plastic bags, leaves, paper, or similar soft material. And random was used to modify litter to clarify that it's not a load of litter that we're exempting. It just is something that may fly out of your vehicle that you were unaware of and didn't consciously load in there. Subsection E on page 2, lines 22 through 24, this specifies that in a prosecution under A or B, which is failure to contain or confine a load in the first or second degree, respectively, a person being convicted in the preceding 10 years of a violation, which is simply just the failure to contain or confine a load in a third degree, is prima facie evidence that the person acted with criminal negligence when securing a load. And prima facie just means that it at first glance, at first look. So it's a rebuttable presumption that a person under prosecution in this section would be able to rebut. And subsection F1 on page 2, lines 25 through 27, this specifies that failure to contain or confine a load in the first degree is a Class A misdemeanor. Subsection F2 on page 2, lines 28 through 29, specifies that failure to contain or confine a load in the second degree is a Class B misdemeanor. Subsection F3A, B, C, and D on page 2, line 30 through page 3, line 7, specifies that failure to contain a load in the third degree, which is an infraction, is punishable by a fine of not more than $300 on the first offense, $750 on the second offense, $1,500 on the third offense, and $2,500 on the fourth offense. And again, the penalty for the first violation is consistent with current statute. Subsection G on page 3, lines 7 through 8. This subsection specifies that criminal negligence in this section has the meaning given in AS 81-900, and that definition is that it's a deviation from the standard of care, a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would observe in perceiving a risk that existed. Section 2 on page 3, lines 5 through 6, AS 2835-253 is amended by adding new subsections. This is really just a conforming amendment to reflect the repeal and reenactment of AS 2535-251, which is the confined load statute in Section 1 of the bill, and the repeal of 2835-255. 255 houses the penalties for violations of both 2835-251 and 2835-253. This is where it gets complicated. The violating 253 is currently an infraction, so because we repealed one of those sections, we had to put back in to 253 that it's still an infraction because the penalty for that statute was housed in one of the sections we repealed. And then on that point, Section 3 on page 3, line 11, repeals 255.
Have any questions for the bill sponsor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have a few questions. One, and maybe this is something for someone, your lifeline, do you know how many folks may have a second infraction under the current law, or how many repeat offenders they just...
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I do not have that information. I believe that might be a question for Captain Loudon online. I'm not sure if they track subsequent offenses of the current violation, given that there is no sliding scale penalty currently, but I would defer that question to the department.
Next question.
Next question would be, I understand, you know, folks that have suffered loss through, and I drove off into the ditch with a flying trash can coming at me, but isn't more the penalties for serious harm covered through insurance or covered through the process of going through civil court and process, and that to sort of criminalize, you know, someone who's just moving down the road and, you know, a strap comes loose? I mean, we've all seen sort of straps falling off the highways from time to time driving down, and, you know, we do our best to secure the load, but sometimes just gust of wind may jog something, or sometimes DOT doesn't get around to paving those roads along the Glen Highway going to Anchorage. Wink, wink. So I just didn't know if there's a better process in place to, if that's already covered through sort of the civil courts.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, to your point, I would like to point out that under that scenario, somebody who strapped their load and the strap came loose wouldn't be liable for a criminal penalty under this bill, because they would not have acted with criminal negligence when they secured their load. And the criminal negligence being, if I have permission to read, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chairman, a person acts with criminal negligence with respect to a result or a circumstance described by a provision of law defining an offense when a person fails to perceive a substantial and unjustifiable risk that will occur or that the circumstances exist. And here's the important part. The risk must be such a nature and degree that the failure to perceive it constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would observe in the situation. So we ran this analysis of what types of situations somebody could be criminally liable under this. So you would have had to basically fail to perceive a situation that the reasonable person, and it would have to be in a gross deviation of that standard of care, and it has to result in the serious physical injury of another person. So forgetting for a moment the serious physical injury part, someone who makes an attempt to secure a load or that a reasonable person wouldn't perceive as a risk wouldn't be liable under the statute. To the second part of your question, I suppose, you know, if the rep has something to add to that, I think that would, you know, that would be a perspective she might want to add. But I think when we were drafting this, we viewed that offense as serious enough nature if those two circumstances existed, the serious physical injury and the criminal negligence, to rise to the level of a misdemeanor instead of leaving somebody to civil recourses.
And I will add one thing. In addition to what Matt has just explained, it takes so very little time and very little effort to secure a load when it could very possibly be saving a life.
And if you can identify yourself for the records.
Oh,
for the
excuse me, Representative Stutz.
And just a follow-up question on that.
Through the chair.
And so, you know, my concern is, you know, I've been through Anchorage and I've seen people, you know, go and they want to buy a new mattress and, you know, and they try to quickly hold on tight to the, you know, box springs or the mattress on top, or try to do it with a quick little twine and that they are provided at the store. And I mean, that's not adequately, but I just fear that some people who just may want to help a friend move and just say, hey, yeah, I can come over to my truck and we're not going to tie anything down, we're only going to do a short distance, and then, you know, something falls off. I don't want to create a problem for them. I just don't know if that would interfere with them and not knowing that that's not a secure load, or, you know, or these other laws apply. And since I just didn't know how this, if it's passed into law, how would those folks know that, hey, I'm just trying to help a friend move. Now I'm got a $300 misdemeanor fine.
Representative Stutz through the chair. Senator Wilson, when you just put something that you know can fall out of your truck in your truck and you don't secure it, and you are taking the chance of severely injuring or even killing another person, it's not like I'm just going to help my friend move. You know, I would think that you would be quite aware that if you have large items that have the potential to come out of your truck and maim or injure someone else, it needs to be secured. And that's almost, to me, that's almost common sense.
Thank you.
Follow-up question, Senator Ian?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, either for Representative Stutz or Mr. Greening. I'm assuming there's you've seen the letter from Hayes Thompson from the Alaska Trucking Association saying it's not needed. That this piece of legislation isn't needed.
Is that the question?
Do you have a response to that?
Through the chair, Senator Egan, I am familiar with that letter. I actually submitted it in the packet to the committee. Their letter basically states that they view is that they're already regulated and that it duplicates requirements they already have in law.
But it doesn't do anything about the general public, correct?
Let him finish answering the question, then you can have a follow-up.
So they are heavily regulated when it comes to their requirements to strap, to secure. They have a very, very in-depth requirements for how they secure their loads. The public right now does not. And the Trucking Association's issue, although it doesn't state it in the letter, I know through private conversations with them, is the requirement to tarp gravel or have 6 inches of freeboard. That exemption has been in law in Washington State for almost 10 years. There hasn't been an issue. I suppose my counter to their letter would be that if it simply duplicates requirements that they already have but covers the public and also makes a little more stringent requirements for how they're supposed to deal with their gravel, I would say that it is needed.
Do you have a follow-up, Senator Egan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no other questions, we'll move on now to the public hearing portion. I'd like to start by having you introduce yourself for the record, who you represent. I think what we'll do is we'll have Kelly Roy come up in person. She's in the room. She can come forward, please. Come forward, jump in the hot seat, and just introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill, and don't worry, we won't bite you or anything. We're not scary.
Okay.
I'll keep these guys in line if they get carried away.
Trust you.
Okay. For the record, my name is Kelly Roy, and I represent myself.
Okay. And if you could pull the microphone up a little bit so they can pick you up. Just pull it right for you. There you go.
That?
Yep.
Is that better? Mm-hmm. Okay. So a little over 3 years ago, I was driving to work, and among the other cars during the commute was a truck carrying an unsecured load. I had no idea the impact that truck was about to have on my life. That truck's unsecured load suddenly came straight towards me at highway speeds. I don't remember much about what happened next. I remember there being trash and bits of wood, but the biggest object was a trash can, the kind that you put at the end of your driveway. The next thing I remember is being in the emergency room and a police officer trying to ask me questions. I was told that my car rolled 4 times and that the fire department had to cut me out of my vehicle because I was trapped. I had broken bones, countless bruises, and bleeding both on the outside and inside of my brain. Did you know that bleeding on the inside of the brain has a survival rate of about 30%? I survived those odds, but not without consequence. It's been years, and I'm still in therapy. I've been fighting for a really long time to get back what I lost for something that could have been prevented. And it's because something or someone couldn't be bothered to even try to secure their load. And the worst part about that day was that the driver had never stopped. They left me there on that highway, and they left deciding that my life was worth less than all that trash that was on that highway with me. Having a traumatic brain injury has drastically changed my life. I fight every day to get better. That driver is responsible for what happened to me. Their actions ripped away my ability to be a person, to walk, have a conversation, even to hold someone's hand or hug them. Years to get back the simplest of things that are simple yet so important. They could have spent 5 minutes to make sure their load was secured, but they didn't. They didn't even try, and that 5 minutes not spent, I have paid for the rest of my life. A person chooses not to secure their load just as a person chooses to get behind the wheel of a car drunk. Both drivers don't leave with the intention to harm anyone, but the negligent choice was made because it took less of their time and was more convenient, even though that choice put others at risk. I was able to get some data from the Alaska Anchorage landfill. Matt had mentioned that in 2016, there were 1,392 citations given out for unsecured loads. And I also have last year in 2017, there were 1,191 citations given out for unsecured loads. A consistent problem that is resulting in more than one vehicle on the road every day that is driving unsafely, and that's just going to the dump in just the Anchorage area. My hope is that this bill will educate and remind every person how dangerous that an unsecured load really is, and that this bill will protect everyone in this room and every Alaskan in this state, and will hold these negligent drivers accountable for a choice that has hurt and killed so many people. I ask that you help me make this change. Help me change a law that cannot protect me and cannot protect you or anyone you love unless there is change. What happened to me was entirely preventable. I will not get justice for that day, but I can fight for change with your help. I see unsecured loads every day. Every day. And I know that this change is right and it is needed. And I hope that you see that too and you help me make this possible. I'm very grateful to be here today, and I thank you for taking the time to listen to me and my story.
Thank you for your testimony. Do we have any questions? Or? Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Next, we're going to go on the off-net, ask Robin Abel if she can introduce herself for the record, who they represent, and speak to the bill, please.
Yes, thank you. My name is Robin Abel. I'm a mother in Seattle, Washington, and I'm here today to tell you why it's so important to change this law. I'm under the weather, so I'm going to read my statement, if you don't mind, because it's so important that I do this correctly. Dear Maria, my husband was driving behind you on the way home from work Sunday night, February 22, 2004. He stopped at the scene of your accident. He broke his way into your vehicle. He heard you breathing. He talked to 911. He held your hand. He encouraged you to hang in there. He drove home and kissed his three children and wife goodnight. Days later, tears still well up in his eyes, for he knows that where his story ends, yours begins. It was 14 years ago in February that I got the call that's every parent's worst nightmare. It was Harborview Hospital, and this woman said to me, "Is your daughter Maria Federici?" It was the only time in my life that I ever wanted to say no. I'd always been so proud to be Maria's mother, but in that moment, I didn't want that call to be about my daughter. So I said yes, and she said, "She's in critical condition. You need to get here as soon as you can." That wasn't the call I expected. It was Sunday night around midnight. Maria was 24, graduated from college, and not living at home. But suddenly, I knew life had just changed. When I got to the hospital, a social worker took me to a quiet room. No one had told me if Maria was still alive, so I grabbed this woman's arm as she reached for the door and said, "Is she still alive?" And she said, "I don't know." We went in and sat down, and within minutes, the doctors came in, but they didn't say anything. I looked up. Their coats were so clean and white. There was no blood.
and these doctors couldn't have been older than my daughter. Finally, I said, can you save her? They just shook their heads, but I asked again, are you sure you can't save it? They said she was bleeding out from the center of the brain. It was a matter of time. Then I knew why they were there. I said, are you here for her organs? And they said, yes. I knew Maria would have wanted that, so I spent the next few hours filling out the forms. Not an easy thing to do in times of grief. As my brother was driving me home to get my dogs and to go back to his home in Port Orchard, he told me what happened to Maria. She had just finished her shift that night, closed the restaurant up, and headed home around 11:15 p.m. Someone ahead of her had lost a large black entertainment center, and the board that went through Maria's windshield weighed 40 pounds. She was almost completely decapitated. She lost her eye sockets, her cheekbones, her nose, her upper palate was crushed, and a good part of her frontal lobe had been destroyed. She had no face, only a large hole that went back a quarter inch from her spinal column. Hearing that, I realized it was probably best that Maria had passed away that night, because what would the quality of her life have been like? Around 7 a.m., the phone rang again, and it was Harborview. They said, come back, she is still alive. Because I had donated her organs, they had kept her alive for organ donation, and now realized that this young woman was still fighting for her life. But now I was even more scared, because what would the quality of her life be like? The doctor said she will never see, hear, speak, and we don't think she'll be able to move, and we know she will have severe brain damage. And they even asked me for a photo because they didn't know what she looked like, and I really didn't understand how bad it had been. At one point, they had almost 30 doctors working on her, and in the first surgery of 15 hours, they gave her a new face. How is my daughter going to survive financially for the rest of her life? Her face had just cost over $1 million, and now there was a lifetime of medical and daily care needed. I contacted the King County prosecutor, and that's when he told me that what happened to Maria was not a crime. It was a littering ticket. That meant Maria wouldn't even be eligible to apply for crime victims compensation. I immediately said it may be too late for my daughter, but it is not too late to change the law to protect other families on the road. Norm Mailing agreed to help me change the law, telling me that the tough work begins afterwards to educate the public. Maria's law passed the first year. Early on, we met with the truckers and gained their immediate support. They understood this law enhanced their current six-inch rule, and they didn't consider this change anything but good for safety. You know, the tough work begins after the law is changed. It's one thing to change a law, but a lifetime commitment to educate the public on the importance of load securement. And I think that Kelly is really an exhibit of a fine citizen, because she's the one bringing this to you, and her only hope is that you will pass this bill to save lives with all of this. I do want to address civil court because someone brought it up and I don't have a chance to respond. You have to have someone to go after to go to get civil justice, and it takes you years. And when you do get that check, it is no justice. I'm here to tell you that. So please pass House Bill 259. I know it will save lives, injuries, and millions of dollars in litter. And lastly, Maria is blind, but she can hear. She can talk. She can walk and dance. She doesn't believe her life has changed at all, and that is a good thing about the brain injury. But I miss my daughter and the life we have. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Sam. Have any questions? Okay, let's go to Aves Thompson from Alaska Truckers. Aves, if you can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, and speak to the bill, please.
Mr. Chairman, this is Aves Thompson with the Alaska Trucking Association. Before I start, I'd like to offer my sympathies to Mrs. Federici and to Kelly. Those are injuries that should never have occurred. Senator Egan mentioned a letter that we had written concerning this bill. And I was planning to read it, but since you have it in your packet, there's probably not a point. The point of the letter is, indeed, that our industry is highly regulated by both federal and state statute and regulation. The commercial vehicle load securement regulations are very detailed, very specific. I believe we do a pretty good job. Occasionally, there's something that falls off, but I'm not aware of any injuries that have resulted from dropping or or leaking or spilling of loads. I would. The reference was made to the 1,300 violations at the municipal landfill in Anchorage. In all of our discussions with the Senator, or with the Representative Stutes and her staff and others, we've never objected to securing loads. Loads should be secured. Our only point here is that commercial vehicles are already bound by strict statute and regulation to secure their loads. So when I say that this, we feel this law is duplicative, it is relative to our industry that I believe it is duplicative. And for that reason, I don't believe that, that this piece of legislation should cover commercial vehicles. And I'll be happy to try to answer any questions. Well, let me make one more point. Representative Stutes mentioned that it's very easy and very inexpensive to secure your loads. I might point out that a canvas cover, canvas tarp for a belly dump or an end dump can run anywhere from $6,000 to $8,000 each installed on a truck. So there's a cost here. That's not our primary mover here. We feel that we're doing a safe job, that we are containing our loads, and that, again, as far as this particular law is concerned, we don't feel that it's necessary for our industry. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for Mr. Thompson? Okay, seeing none, that concludes everybody that signed up on the screen here. Anybody in the room want to testify that hasn't signed up yet? Seeing none, if we could have the bill sponsor come forward, please.
Mr. Chair.
If
Senator Wilson.
Yeah, if we could, I believe there's some folks online that may be able to answer the question, the law enforcement officer, about duplicative tickets, or if there's ways to track that, and then I do have a question for DOT as well.
Okay, that's fine. We can do that. We have Captain Dan Loden. Is he still online?
Mr. Chair, this is Captain Loden. Yes, I'm still on the line.
Did you hear the question from Senator Wilson, or do you want him to repeat
it? Through the chair, this is Captain Loden with the State Troopers in Anchorage. I don't have a number handy for you. I can ask our computer folks to see if there is a number that we could provide for public safety. The problem that I found in answering this question in a variety of ways that we get asked for the number of traffic citations for a thing in the state of Alaska is that there is no central repository for those citations. Not even in the court system. Some municipalities have their own ordinances. They cite for those ordinances. They collect their fines through the city, and there's no report made to the state about what occurs. So I think if I were to look into it, I'd probably be able to tell you what the State of Alaska Department of Public Safety number is, but I couldn't give you any kind of definitive number for the across the state.
Senator Wilson, you have a follow-up?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Captain. If you can get that information back to the committee, we'd appreciate it. And Senator Wilson, you have another question for DOT?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
We can have the DOT rep in the room come forward and jump in the hot seat. He's got to earn his keep today. Go ahead, Senator Wilson.
Yeah, just going through the article that was in our packet here, they mention under the state highway safety programs that there are states that are available, there are funds available to states that may want to raise campaigns and awareness posed by insecure. Is that state funding, I mean, federal funding available to our state? Have our state looked into that or history of any type of awareness campaigns upon this issue that the state has done?
Good afternoon. Mr. Chairman, committee members, for the record, Mike Lessman, legislative liaison for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I will have to get back to you with an answer on that question.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Senator?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Any for anyone else?
I'm all done. Okay.
If we can have the bill sponsor come forward, and if she has any final comments before we set this bill aside?
Matt, you want to respond?
Through the chair, for the record, again, Matt Greening, staff to Representative Louise Stutes. I did want to take the opportunity to respond to two things that Abe Thompson, the director of the Trucking Association, raised. The first being, we do agree that they have stringent standards for load securement. From our perspective, though, we don't see why the bill should not apply to them if one of their operators, with criminal negligence, failed to secure their load and it killed another person. If they don't abide by their own securement standards with criminal negligence and that result occurs, we have a difficult time seeing why the public would be liable to that standard, but the truckers wouldn't. And to his point about the cost of tarping, we did that analysis. We did come up with a different figure than $8,000. It was closer to $2,500 to $3,000. But that being said, the 6-inch freeboard exemption has existed in law for a long time in Washington State. DOT's fiscal note is a zero fiscal note because they already abide by the 6-inch freeboard exemption for dirt, rock, sand, and gravel, or similar materials. So there's two options in the bill. There is tarp or 6 inches of freeboard around the perimeter. DOT can abide by it. The Washington State truckers can abide by it. I don't see how it's going to require them to all purchase tarps.
Okay. You have any other final comments before we set this bill aside?
No, we just want to thank you for taking the time to hear our bill. And we want to thank Kelly for flying down to give you her perspective on this as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll set this bill aside for further review. That concludes the meeting today. The next scheduled meeting is Thursday, 1:30. We'll keep the committee members posted. There are no other business to come before the committee today. We are adjourned.